1955, England. A dark-haired man sits looking pensive in a prison cell. Now he's sitting with a tight-lipped woman in a car, in strained silence.
Any man who takes a criminal path.
The woman gets out.
Should be mindful of the consequences.
He lets out a sigh. Now in shirt and tie, the man settles down at a typewriter.
My name is Peter Wildblood.
A headline reads, men described as filthy, dirty beasts.
May I ask the Right Honourable Home Secretary the number of cases involving male perversion this year and how he intends to deal with this evil?
Much of my private life has already been made public by the newspapers, so I have nothing left to hide.
Other headlines read, how to spot a possible homo and growth of an evil.
And over 600 offenders sent to prison.
Peter in his cell.
I don't pity myself, and I do not ask for pity. But I am speaking out. To give some hope and courage to other men like myself and to the rest of the world some understanding. I am a homosexual.
He slams the wall.
So long as I held office, I shall give no countenance to the view that they should not be prevented from being such a danger.
Starring Daniel Mays, Richard Gadd, Mark Gatiss and Charlie Creed Miles. Adapted from the book by Peter Wildblood. Against the Law, based on a true story. Three years earlier, it's night time. Peter Wildblood approaches a pub on a street corner and takes a thoughtful drag on his cigarette. After hesitating for several moments, he heads inside. He removes his fedora and approaches the bar. The softly lit bar seems to have an exclusively male clientele. Peter pays for his drink, then steps aside to take in his surroundings. Swallowing nervously, he watches a couple of barflies chatting. Then the barman turns away to serve two newly arrived sailors in uniform. Looking as if he's going to be sick, Peter remembers the woman in the car's accusing face. Then he notices an old man at a table, giving him the eye. One of the sailors slaps a barfly on the bum. At a station, a young RAF corporal with a brown moustache sparks up a cigarette as he waits. In the bar, Peter takes a last drag of his cigarette. Then, summoning his courage, taps one of the sailors on the shoulder.
I wonder, could I buy you a drink?
Does it work that way, darling? Unless you're willing to play the part.
The barfly offers Peter a powder compact.
So you're not a queen, then? It's a pity. You're quite pretty, really. Not so rough, either.
I'm a homosexual.
What?
Homosexual?
Homosexual? I see. I thought that was just something doctors called us. Do all the queens use this word now?
I don't know.
I'm not sure I like it.
Come along, Fanny, dear.
See you later, dear heart.
Coming, ducky.
When the camp barfly Fanny heads out, Peter watches him with a flicker of a smile. Then, after thinking for a moment, Peter downs his whiskey. Now, interviews with men in the present day.
At that particular time, there was a, you might call it a purge, on people who were gay.
We were considered sick. We were considered you know, child molesters.
The police went out of their way to catch you. And the members of parliament, this filth and this is going to ruin the nation. We must stop it out. I can't remember the name of the Home Secretary at the time, but he was one of the worst.
David Maxwell Fyfe, Sir David Maxwell Fyfe, later Viscount Kilmure. Well, he embodied all the worst attitudes of the British establishment.
He could be arrested for just looking at somebody in the street, you know, winking at them or smiling at them. And I thought, this is mad. The world has gone a bit potty.
I have to say, it made it even more exciting because, you know, it is exciting, avoiding the police, keeping a lookout. It's like being a member of an underground sect or something, and you get a great kick out of it.
Wherever you went was liable to be raided. Whether it was a pub, or it was a private drinking club, or it was a private party. And you would have your name and address printed in the paper.
Back in the 1950s, Peter stands on a street corner and lights up a cigarette. As he turns to walk on, he bumps into the corporal from the station.
Oh! Oh, I'm sorry.
It's fine.
Peter gawps at him.
Do you need directions?
No, I'm down off leave from Ely. And it's gonna rain again. Any minute.
Without breaking eye contact, Peter smiles and takes a drag. Later, he shows the corporal into his lamplit sitting room. The corporal casts a casual eye over the place.
So, if you want to stay, there's a sofa which should be perfectly comfortable.
Yeah, it should, yeah. It's a bit small.
He turns to Peter in the doorway and plays with Peter's tie.
And besides, you and I could, fuck. Maybe. Never know.
Tentatively, Peter takes the man by the hand and leads him into an upstairs bedroom. They stand facing each other in the lamplight, their faces inches apart. When Peter goes to undo his tie, the man stops him and does it for him. With their eyes locked in an intense gaze, the man discards the tie, then unbuttons Peter's shirt. Naked, they lie back on the bed with the man on top. Gripping his neck, Peter kisses him hungrily. They stop kissing and look at each other, then continue at a more leisurely pace. The man props himself up, then takes Peter's wrist to turn him over onto his front. As the man gets ready on top, Peter grips the edge of the mattress. Then the man laces his fingers through Peter's, and they hold on together. Peter's lips part as the man thrusts into him. Later, they lie in each other's arms and share a tender kiss. Later still, Peter chuckles as he lies on his back with his lover beside him watching.
What? You and I could fuck, maybe?
What?
The romance of it.
Dead. Romantic. That's one of my best lines.
Now Peter is in a vest and pajama bottoms and sitting having a tea and a smoke while watching his lover get dressed.
You're heading back to Ely?
In 2 days, yeah. So what do you do?
I'm a journalist.
Oh, right. Which paper?
The Mail.
Nice.
Not really, it's quite dull, actually.
Peter sips his tea, and his lover ties his laces. Now wearing a red dressing gown, Peter seeing his lover to the door.
Well, it was nice meeting you.
I'll, keep in touch. I mean it. Do you want me to?
Well, yes, I'm...
All right, then.
With his kit bag slung over his shoulder, the corporal steps up to the door. Peter opens it. Then, with a nod, his lover leaves, and Peter closes the door behind him. Hazy sunshine casting a tree into silhouette.
Being gay was a very tricky business. It was frowned upon by society. It was punishable by imprisonment. It was illegal. It was everything you could mention.
I mean, you couldn't even talk about it. I felt very uncomfortable about it, certainly.
If heterosexuals have been subject to the force of law for being heterosexual, if their relations have been frowned upon, it's most unlikely that they would have settled into long-term marriages. They had public opinion and the law behind them. In the case of homosexuals, the law and public opinion were very distinctly against them. So I think the whole climate was opposed to the building of relationships. In fact, I think many gay people half believed, because they were told so often, that if you were gay, you couldn't have a relationship.
It was a no-no, so I had to be on my own. And so I've been used to it since childhood, being a loner. Never enjoyed it, I can tell you. It was awful. But that's the way it is.
Peter's dozing on the sofa when he's awoken by the door. His lover eddies in civvies and clutching red flowers.
Well, would you look at that? He meant what he said.
Peter pulls him inside, then they share a long, lusty kiss. Now in a park, they stroll a little self-consciously along a public footpath through sun-dappled trees. They sit down on a bench overlooking some men playing football.
Fancy a kick around?
You're joking.
No, not physical then. Not even at school.
Football? I was useless. Always the last to get picked.
I can imagine, actually.
I used to just gather with all the other outcasts. Teachers despised us for it. One of them said, "Ah, yes, there they are. The sops. Sops of a feather flock together."
Their eyes meet. Then Peter goes to surreptitiously stroke Eddie's hand with his pinky, but Eddie gets up.
Come on.
Later, as the sun shines behind a tree, Peter's in his kitchen frying an egg. Eddie comes through from the sitting room, holding a framed black and white photo of a young boy.
Is that you?
Stop it.
Peter smiles and takes the photo back.
We have to be a lot more careful than that.
I know, I'm unschooled.
Telling me. Am I the only poof you know?
No. I know Edward. Lord Montague, through my work. Smile all you like, Mr. Inverted Snob. He's very nice.
Now Peter is with two friends in a gentleman's club.
So it's love, then?
To be honest, I didn't thought you'd come out of your shell far enough.
Neither did I.
What's his appeal?
He's confident. Physical. A bit dim, sort of. I suppose I always thought...
Go on.
I thought I'd meet a boy like him and he would make me brave. And in return, I would make him wise.
You're blushing.
All right, it's stupid, you know. It's comradeship. Plato wrote something along those lines, do you know it? Two men, very different strengths, but when they come together, an army of such lovers could conquer the world.
Bring him down to Bewley. When did you last have a holiday?
Oh, God. 3-4 years ago.
Bring him down to Bewley.
Montague Estate, Bewley. As the sun sets behind the trees, Peter, Eddie and other men arrive at the stately home, where a light's glowing from every window.
Just a small party.
God, you are such a... Live a little? Yes?
Later, a veil of cloud drifts past a full moon. Inside, men are busy chatting at the party, but Eddie's sitting out on the step by himself, having a drink and a smoke. Peter comes out and joins him.
Well, I think this party is really rather...
Boring? Boring as fuck?
Yes, that's about the size of it. I thought the aristocracy knew how to let its hair down.
Mm-hmm. You thought wrong.
When Peter goes to nab Eddie's lit cigarette, Eddie pulls back and slowly puts it between Peter's lips himself. Peter takes a drag. As they sit facing each other, intimately close, Eddie suddenly kisses Peter on the lips.
What happened to be careful?
No one about. You daft, eh?
Peter kisses him back. Now they're asleep in bed in the half-light, with their arms wrapped around each other. So why
not take all of me? I know.
Eddie's back in uniform. Peter unlocks his front door, but doesn't yet open it. Then, cupping Eddie's face, he kisses him tenderly on the lips. The wireless sits next to a breadboard in Peter's modest kitchen. Peter's leaning on the windowsill, with his head resting on his hand, and a sad, faraway look in his eye. Later, he takes a sip of whiskey, then sits down at a desk next to a gramophone. Pulling the lid off a pen, Peter starts to write a letter. Go on,
dear, without you. My dearest, darling Eddie. You took the best. I love you so much. Why not take the rest? There. Baby, take all of me.
Now, interviews with men in the present day.
In the 50s, homosexuals were in a kind of secret world of their own. They were on another rather delightful planet in a way.
It was fabulous. I was doing whatever young people do. I wanted to dance. I wanted to have beautiful clothes. I wanted to have lots of sex. I wanted somebody to love me.
It was a world in which there was no class difference at all. And that, I think, was one of the things which made it very, very attractive.
Members of the upper classes have always fancied members of the lower classes. I was never actually particularly attracted to posh boys, but I did sometimes meet them if they looked right. So I did find myself in the situation of mixing with a much wider range of social classes, I think, than straight boys of my background would have done.
There was this strong sense of community within the gay world, and that rendered us not impervious, but able to resist these awful, this constant barrage of propaganda, of depiction of us as being evil.
Rain trickling down a window pane. Peter answers his phone.
Wildblood?
Peter, it's Edward.
Oh, hello, Edward.
Are you alone?
Yes?
I'm at the police station. I called them about a camera that went missing at my place.
I'm fairly sure it was
one of the Boy Scouts we have showing the public round on open days.
That's terrible.
The Boy Scout made certain allegations against me. False, of course.
I'm a public figure, Peter. They're trying to make an example of me.
Well, I thought you should know.
Yes, thank you, Edward. Good luck.
December 1953, at a courthouse.
At Winchester Assize, the trial of Lord Montagu continues. He stands accused of indecently assaulting a boy.
A minor. He took the stand to claim his innocence and said he was the victim of a police witch hunt.
In bed, Peter strokes the empty pillow beside him, then later turns on the wireless.
In news, at 5 o'clock, Lord Montagu of Beaulieu was today acquitted of several counts of indecent assault. The jury's decision was unanimous and brings to an end an acrimonious trial in which Lord Montagu claimed to be the victim of a smear.
Peter heaves a sigh of relief. Now interviews with men in the present day.
When the trial collapsed and the public realised that it was all manufactured evidence, the general public did find that distasteful.
It made me feel angry, really. When I look back on it, and I thought, yeah, I was quite angry about this rubbish. You know, I got quite worked up about it.
I mean, all gay men throughout the country felt that. And not only gay men, but the general public, luckily, were feeling that.
Why is Montagu being harassed like this? What is the point? It seemed to me it did turn public opinion against all that was going on.
But on the other hand, I think there was a kind of feeling among the police force that they would get him in the end.
Back in the 1950s, a detective sitting in an interview room is given a pile of letters. Throwing a smile across the table, he unfolds the top letter and reads it. It begins, "My darling Eddie, I dreamt of you last night."
These letters, who wrote them?
Eddie looks uncomfortable.
You know who wrote them.
I want to hear it from you. Give me the dirt on Montagu and his two pals. Look, you might lose your job, but I'll keep you out of prison.
Outside Peter's house. The detective's at the door.
Are you Peter Wildblood?
Yes? I'm arresting you on charges of gross indecency and buggery with certain other male persons. Where do you sleep?
My bedroom is upstairs.
Anyone up there?
No.
A constable barges past Peter and goes upstairs.
Don't you have a warrant?
The detective follows the constable up. A shocked Peter closes his front door.
Sit down.
With the detective snooping around his things, Peter does as he's told.
You were in Bewley this summer?
Yes.
Are these your parents?
Yes.
And this one is Edward McNally.
The detective gets out the pile of letters and puts them in front of Peter.
Is this your handwriting?
Yes.
In a dank, dingy prison cell, Eddie's sitting under the window, staring into space with tears in his eyes. Perching on the edge of his bath, Peter takes an anxious breath. Then, standing, he leans over the sink and hangs his head, distraught. The tearful Eddie steeples his fingers as he thinks. When the detective steps into the bathroom behind him, Peter turns to face him.
This could go very badly for you. Very badly indeed.
Keeping one hand on the sink to steady himself, Peter sits back on the edge of the bath.
What you should do is make a statement and you just get bound over. Make a clean breast of things. Tell me about Montague and his chum Pitt Rivers and all of them. And then I think you'll...
No. No, I couldn't do that.
And why not?
Because you... Because... Sops of a feather flock together. And you heard.
Now, a despondent Peter toys with a set of heavy handcuffs as he sits in the back of a moving police van. An expressionless constable flicks a glance in his direction. A hatch is opened, then a man peers out as the police van reverses, then stops. A guard steps forward and opens the van's barred doors. Then he takes the handcuffed Peter by the elbow and leads him towards the station. Peter stops outside the door, which is then opened, and the guard escorts him inside. After his fingerprints are taken, Peter poses for a mugshot holding a blackboard with the date 9/1/1954.
The ones, for example, who had previous convictions, it would be a fair cop, very sorry, plead guilty. Those who had never experienced the police intruding would be very upset, and they were the more likely ones who would plead not guilty and challenge every aspect of the observations. I still say it was an inherent weakness, and still is. They went into these practices knowing that there's a great element of risk of being arrested, being exposed, if you'll pardon the expression.
3 or 4 weeks after I met Lee, I realised without doubt that he was the one person I wanted to spend the rest of my life with. I wrote him a long letter telling him of my feelings for him and my hopes for us. I thought he'd be so pleased about this letter, and I couldn't believe it. He was so angry. I said, well, what's the matter? He said, well, the letter you sent to me could have landed us both in prison.
I was 14 years old, and I had a boyfriend, and he had written me a letter very stupidly. And I had dropped the letter. And my father said, watch this. I can remember the note, God bless him. I'm having no son of mine a queer. You're going to the doctor. So I was taken down to the doctor, who said, you've got a disease. This is great. You've got a disease. I never accepted that I had an illness. I accepted that I preferred to go to bed with a man rather than a woman. I didn't see that as an illness. But I did see it as something as you kept yourself because of the implications, because of the consequences, if you didn't.
15th March, 1954.
You are each charged with gross indecency, buggery, attempted buggery, aiding and abetting buggery, procuring male persons for acts of gross indecency, and conspiracy to incite male persons to commit gross indecency. To each of these charges, how do you, Edward Montague, plead?
Not guilty.
To each of these charges, how do you, Michael Pitt Rivers, plead?
Not guilty.
And to each of these charges, how do you, Peter Wildblood, plead?
Not guilty.
A jury of grim-faced older men look on at the three in the dock. Later, Peter is shown into a holding cell, where Edward and Michael are already waiting. He sits down between them on a wooden bench.
Right.
I've been better.
Right. The form is, basically, we deny everything. None of us are queer. We've never dabbled, never even been tempted. Right?
It's very hard to prove. The word love on a page means nothing. I thought we'd be all right. We were discreet. Why are they doing this?
Stay calm, Peter.
In uniform, Eddie is walking up the court steps with another RAF man. The court's in session.
The case for the prosecution begins with Wildblood. In March 1952, Wildblood met an RAF corporal in Piccadilly. His name is McNally, and he'll be called as a witness. McNally is a pervert. Wildblood took him back to his flat, and there committed an offense, namely buggery, with this McNally. McNally had a friend, John Reynolds, also queer. You probably know the meaning of that term. Wildblood was a friend of Lord Montague. Mention was made to Lord Montague of this John Reynolds. Introductions were arranged. Offences against Reynolds were committed by Montague at Wildblood's flat in London. And on a trip to Bewley, joined by Michael Pitt Rivers, an orgy took place. McNally and Reynolds are men of the lowest possible moral character. Taken under the seductive influence of lavish hospitality of these three men, so infinitely their social superiors, they were willing parties to unnatural acts. It would be dangerous to convict any of the defendants purely on the evidence of men such as McNally and Reynolds. We hope to satisfy you by letters and other documents that there is copious confirmation that the story these men, Reynolds and McNally, are telling is true.
The unsmiling judge sits back in his seat. On the stairs outside, two men are standing together smoking.
And on that date in December when you attended his property, did you see Wildblood?
He came to the door.
Where did you go with him?
To the living room.
Did you suggest to him that he write a statement?
No, sir.
Did you promise him that if he write a statement, he just be bound over?
I did not.
And the letters you showed him, he recognized these as letters written by himself and McNally.
Indeed, he did, sir.
I didn't think this could happen in Britain. I didn't think the police...
Well, now you know.
The rotten apples aren't the odd ones out, Peter.
They're bastards.
Jesus,
try.
try to stay calm.
In wig and gown, a court clerk walks past where Eddie and his friend John Reynolds are sitting.
You're next, McNally. Call Edward McNally.
In the dock, Peter turns his head and watches as Eddie passes by just below. Eddie doesn't look up at him. Eddie's directed to cross the court. The detective and some older men in suits watch from the gallery, and the unsmiling judge sits forward as Eddie climbs the steps to the witness box, then takes a seat.
You are Edward McNally?
Yes.
Do you know the accused, Peter Wildblood?
Yes.
Look at the accused and confirm that he is the man known to you. When you spent the night at his flat, where did you sleep?
In the bedroom with Wildblood.
Did anything occur between you?
We committed buggery with each other.
Did you write this letter to him, Exhibit 44?
Eddie's handed the letter.
Yes.
Dearest Peter, I've really got it bad, sweetheart. In fact, I haven't felt so happy for a long time. Just to let you know, I haven't forgotten you, and I never will. Did you mean those words?
I thought I did, sir.
Were you what you would describe as in love with Peter Wildblood?
Yes, sir.
Did you receive this letter from him, Exhibit 45?
Yes.
You are so much a part of my life that I do not think I could ever do without you. I love you as much now as I did when we spent our lovely holiday together.
In the dock, Peter remembers writing the letter and cupping Eddie's face in his hands.
Did you believe those words?
I suppose so, sir.
Did you believe Peter Wildblood to be in love with you?
Yes, sir.
In flashback, Eddie getting dressed and glancing towards Peter. Then Eddie's stricken face in the witness box. Afterwards, Peter's with Edward and Michael in an anteroom.
Why did he do this to me? Why did Eddie do this?
You know why he did it.
To save his own skin.
Forget him.
Hanging his head, Peter turns his face away from Edward and fights back tears. Now archive film of a naval aircraft carrier cutting across a choppy sea.
I joined the Navy 10 days before my 17th birthday. It was on HMS Reggio that I was, to put it crudely, caught in the act. I was court-martialed, charged with buggery and gross indecency. Then I was asked to give the names of the people with whom I had slept or had anything to do with, and was told, if you tell us their names, you're looking at 12 months. If you don't tell us your names, you're looking at 5 years. I gave them the name of an army officer with whom I'd spent a night ashore. They found him, and one day the warder, Screw, came in and said, the chap's blown his brains out. And that is something which I've had to live with for over 60 years. It is still... I hate myself for it, but it was just one of those things.
17th March, 1954.
Call Peter Wildblood.
In the dock, Edward glances at Michael. Then Peter is shown in by a court officer. Peter makes his way to the witness box. Then the clerk, in wig and gown, hands him the Bible and a card.
Place your right hand on the Bible. Take the card in your other hand and read the statement.
I swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
The clerk takes the Bible and card back.
Counsel for the defence.
Is your name Peter Wildblood?
Yes.
Are you a homosexual, Mr. Wildblood?
Yes, I am.
Thinking back to July 1952, how would you describe your relationship with Edward McNally?
I'd become fond of him. He is not educated, but he is intelligent. My work made me live in a kind of way I didn't much enjoy, and I like to be able to relax with someone who is quite simple, unpretentious, and fond of me.
What kind of letters was he writing to you?
They were emotional letters. They contained endearments of an unusual kind for two men to exchange.
And you wrote similar letters to him?
I was extremely lonely at that time.
You are familiar with what happened to Oscar Wilde?
Oscar Wilde was accused of gross indecency. I have never committed gross indecency nor buggery with anybody.
You never committed these offences with Edward McNally?
No.
The defence counsel sits down. Then the prosecution counsel stands up.
Mr. Wildblood, when you went into this box, you took the oath in solemn form, you realise that?
Yes.
To tell the truth. The whole truth and nothing but the truth.
Yes.
You know that we've heard McNally, your friend of some 21 months, describe in detail what took place between you and him? You've heard the letters sent by you to him during this time read out in this court. Do you still say you've told the whole truth?
I do.
Have you any suggestion, then, as to why McNally would tell such wicked lies about you?
Well, I should have thought his motive was perfectly obvious. He did it to save his own skin.
Were you attracted to McNally?
I was not physically attracted to him.
How do you say you were attracted to him, then?
Emotionally.
Emotionally? This McNally was very much your social inferior. Why then?
During the war, I fought alongside men from many different backgrounds. I don't recall anyone objecting then.
Before God, I entirely commend that sentiment, Mr. Wildblood, but what the jury may wish to know is this. Why would you, a highly intelligent man, a beautiful writer, want to spend 21 months of his life with an uneducated RAF corporal from the pits of Glasgow? That night in Piccadilly when you met, did you smile at each other?
I cannot remember.
When you got into conversation, did a smile pass between you?
I should think possibly, yes.
You took him back to your flat?
He had nowhere to go.
Resisted all temptation?
Yes.
Didn't even kiss him?
No, I did not.
You never felt the need for physical expression of a healthy, emotional young man?
I was incapable of sexual expression.
Incapable? You consulted a doctor?
No.
Dearest Peter, I've really got it bad, sweetheart. What did he got bad? Love, was it not?
Look, I don't accept for a moment.
In fact, I haven't felt so happy for a long time. Because of his friendship with you, yes? Because of his friendship with you. Yes?
Yes.
This is being written in bed. Wish you were here. But the RAF have definite views on such things. Would a young man write those words to you if you and he had not been intimate?
Or this young man would.
My dearest darling Eddie, oh, how relieved I was to hear from you at last. You are so much a part of my life that I do not think I could ever do without you. Was that right?
He was a part of my life.
I love you as much now as I did when we spent our lovely holiday together. On this holiday, you spent that whole time resisting temptation.
Yes.
What then made it so happy for you?
The friendship, you know, the conversation, the bathing.
The weather? All the love I've ever known, P.
That was all the love I've ever known.
Your arrest must have placed a considerable burden on you.
Peter bows his head further.
If you were born a sexual invert, you will always have a burden on your soul. If there was any way of getting rid of it, I should only be too pleased. Because it has been a handicap to me and led to nothing but loneliness and unhappiness.
I have no further questions.
Witnesses dismissed.
Edward glances again at Michael next to him in the dark. High up amongst chimney stacks, an autumnal leaf falls from a tree. 24th March 1954. The jury foreman stands up.
To the charge of buggery, do you find the defendants guilty or not guilty?
Guilty.
To the charge of gross indecency, do you find the defendants guilty or not guilty?
Guilty.
To the charge of conspiracy to incite male persons to commit gross indecency, do you find the defendants guilty or not guilty?
Guilty.
To the charge of procuring male persons for acts of gross indecency, do you find the defendants guilty or not guilty?
As Peter stands looking shell-shocked, the foreman mouths the word guilty again. At the RAF station in Ely, a stunned Eddie stares straight ahead as his uniform beret and jacket are briskly removed by an officer who then goes to stand guard at the door. A court official places his hand on Peter's shoulder in the dark. A barrier rises, then Eddie leaves the RAF station in his civvies.
The new trial ended today with jail terms for all three accused. Mr. Justice Ormerod passed sentences of 12 months imprisonment on Lord Montague and 18 months each on Michael Fitzrivers and Peter Wildblood.
Outside the court, a Union flag flutters in the breeze.
I read all about it in the newspapers and I thought, God, God, it's awful. They were determined to get verdict of guilty on the three men involved. Was Montague, Wildblood and Michael Fitzrivers. And they were sent to prison, of course. And the two airmen who testified against them were given immunity.
I didn't know how Peter Wildblood, how he was, how the judiciary and the police behaved. I didn't understand. When I read it, I was filled with terror.
This is the kind of stuff that was reality. It was real. This is what happened to you if you were gay.
It was pretty heavy duty. I don't know how it didn't deter me completely. And of course it did deter lots of people. There were lots of very unhappy gay people really trying hard to be straight.
Gradually people were talking. Whereas this had been a taboo, now it was a taboo that was being discussed.
That gave me an edge of hope at a time when I didn't have very much of that around me.
A stony-faced guard sits with his arms folded and a prison-issue uniform and boots and a clipboard in front of him. Standing nervously on the other side of the desk, Peter looks over at a second guard standing by the door. Then, in the awkward silence, Peter starts to undress. He unbuttons his grey, double-breasted suit jacket, pushes down his trousers, then quickly undoes his tie and removes his white shirt. Now standing in just a white vest and underpants, he looks to the guard behind the desk, who just glares back at him. Reluctantly, Peter continues with the humiliating ordeal, pulling off his white vest, then pushing down his underpants. HMP Wormwood Scrubs. Now wearing the prisoner uniform, Peter casts an eye around his small, drab cell. There's a sink against one wall, and a bed with folded bedding on it against the other. A small barred window lets a faint light into the gloom. A flashback to Peter sleeping in Eddie's arms in the half-light. It's still dark when Peter's awoken in his cell. He rolls over onto his back on the bed, then rubs his eyes. Now dressed, he follows a guard into a room, then stops. It's a workshop, where inmates are busy sewing sacks and checking ropes at tables.
Hold on.
Moments later, Peter is sitting with the other prisoners and hard at work. As he pulls on a needle and thread, a man at the far end looks up at him. Feeling his gaze, Peter turns his head in the man's direction. Peter looks away, and the other man returns to his sewing. Now Peter is standing alone in the yard, while other prisoners chat in small groups around him. He blows and rubs his hands against the cold, then notices the man from the workshop openly watching him. He's a bit younger than Peter, and has side-parted brown hair. The man peels away from two other inmates and goes over to Peter, who looks at him with a questioning frown.
I've seen you come in. You look better in real life than you did in the papers.
Oh. Thank you.
I feel like you was dead. Something. How's your porridge going?
It's okay. It's going. Yours?
All right. 2 more years. That Raff lad stitched you up proper, didn't he? Not on. What he did to you.
The man looks Peter up and down.
Seeing you.
Seeing you.
Then with a smile and a glance back at Peter, the man follows the others filing back into the prison. Peter lingers for several moments, alone and looking thoughtfully in the man's direction. Then he, too, goes to leave the yard. Inside, a guard with a baton leads Peter along a dimly lit corridor, then up a flight of stairs. The governor is sitting in his office, looking at a file, when Peter's shown in. The governor doesn't look up.
8505 Wildblood, sir.
Wildblood? Yes. You given any thought to what you might do when you finished your sentence?
I plan to carry on as before, sir.
Well, you'll certainly be returning to an institution like this if you do.
I meant I shall go on writing.
I suspect you'll find that rather harder than you imagine. Do you know someone called Iris?
Why, yes, sir.
Quite a common name in your circles.
Iris is a woman, sir.
You willing to undergo medical treatment for your condition?
Yes, sir.
And you'll see the psychiatrist in due course. That'll be all.
Iris is the woman from the car. Peter and the guard leave the office. Later, Peter stands in silhouette at his cell window.
All the things that once defined me as a man have evaporated. Distilled down to a revolting caricature of homosexual man.
He thumps the wall as intimate moments with Eddie flash through his mind. In a recreation room, Peter sits down by himself to read a newspaper. At another table, he notices an inmate with an angry telltale scar from where he tried to slash his wrist. Another prisoner pulls up a chair. It's Fanny, the barfly.
Hello again. Hello. It's rotten how they did you. There, but for the grace of God, you know.
I'm sorry.
It's people who have a little queer streak of their own that do us most damage, if you ask me. Plus side, this place is packed with queers. Receiving, mostly.
Back in his cell, Peter crouches in the corner between his bed and the wall.
I arrived there with a couple of other prisoners, I think. It really did frighten me.
You had the openly gay people who didn't seem to care if anyone knew they were gay. They flaunted around in groups, were quite outrageous, effeminate, girly names all the time. On the other hand, there were the undercover Marys, as we like to refer to them, those who had, for one reason or another, good reason not to be blatantly gay. And there was certainly a certain tension between them.
The governor said, "We know why you're here. And I want nothing of a homosexual nature for you to try and date, because if you do, you'll be here forever."
Being homosexual was such an aberration, terrible, worse than anything, worse than a murderer, much, much worse.
There were times when one thought, will they ever understand that there's nothing unnatural about us at all? We're perfectly natural human beings with a natural desire for love. And it increased one's sense of alienation from society as a whole.
I mean, it just destroyed my personality, really. I couldn't be who I was, so I had nothing.
Peter is lying awake in his dark cell. Later, in daylight, he washes his face at the sink. May 1954. Peter carries his slop bucket past a prisoner who's mopping the corridor.
I now know what it is like to be a criminal. To know that everything you do will be misunderstood or used as evidence against you.
Peter lying in his dark cell, then later washing his face at the sink again.
It makes me fearful of my future, and fear is a terrible emotion. It's like a black frost which blights and stunts all the other qualities of a man.
October 1954. Peter sitting in the rec room, reading a book and smoking, when the man who spoke to him in the yard pulls up a chair and sits down with him. The man has a magazine tucked into his pocket. As Peter goes back to his reading, the man slides a chocolate bar across the table to him. Peter looks at it in surprise.
Dan, that's really...
Pick it up then.
Peter considers, then quickly puts the bar in his pocket.
Gotta keep your strength up.
Peter taps his cigarette over an ashtray, then goes back to reading his book. Then Dan slides something else across the table to him.
Pinched out the garden. Make yourself feel a bit more like home.
After considering for a moment or two, Peter takes the folded up piece of newspaper and closes it within the pages of his book. When Dan gets out his magazine and starts to read it, Peter looks at him thoughtfully. Back in his cell, Peter sits on his bed, staring down at the folded newspaper. Eventually, he picks it up and opens it. Inside is a single sprig of lavender. Putting the paper aside, Peter holds the delicate sprig between his fingers, then gently lifts it to his nose to inhale its scent. He lets out a tremulous breath, then his face crumples in tears. Still holding the lavender, he punches his hands into fists and covers his eyes. Then he hangs his head and weeps. Now, a guard's leading Peter past a prison hospital ward where a patient projectile vomits on the floor as they pass. A thin man with receding brown hair and a moustache sits waiting at his desk.
Come in. Sit down.
Peter takes a seat.
Wild blood, isn't it?
Yes, sir.
Openly homosexual. Do you attend the orgies?
Orgies?
Yes. In Chelsea and other places, male homosexuals gather together and engage in unnatural practices.
Really?
So I'm told.
I haven't heard of this, sir.
Does not attend the orgies. You want to be cured?
Yes, sir.
Well, there are a number of options.
I understood that glandular injections or hormone treatment.
We've tried estrogen injections on a couple of cases here, but with no great degree of success. One man underwent physical changes of a somewhat alarming nature. We use aversion therapy.
How does that
Electrical aversion. Electrodes fixed to the wrists, calves, feet. You'd be told to fantasize, watch pictures of men in various states of undress, receive shocks.
What does it leave? Marks?
They fade after a while. Or chemical aversion, apomorphine injections, produces nausea. You vomit, then you lie in it. No cleaning up allowed, an essential part of the therapy.
For how long?
2 days, sometimes three, depends.
Peter looks away, thinking.
I shouldn't be here. This shouldn't be happening to me.
You broke the law, Wildblood.
Then the law is wrong.
The doctor picks up his pen, makes a brief note, then nods to the guard by the door. Peter stands up and steps out of the office, and the guard closes the door behind them. Now the interviewees in the present.
The two treatments, the kindest one was that you'd go to a counsellor, a psychologist. The worst option was that you would have aversion therapy. And aversion therapy was probably the three worst days of my 67 years on this earth as a nurse.
They gave me an injection. I don't know to this day what it was. I have been told, but I can't remember now. Which made me feel very queasy and really started to react with inside me and pretty horrendous. And I said, excuse me, I think I'm going to be sick. She said, that's fine, just be sick. So I said, well, could I have a bucket or something or a bowl? No, just be sick. And then started feeling queasy down below. And I said, I've got to go to the toilet. Don't worry about it, just do it.
There was no talk to talk.
about your what you thought, like modern therapy would go into. No dialogue between the therapist and you with regard to your feelings and so on. There was no opportunity to express yourself. It was simply medical treatment with tablets that tried to damp you down.
And for 72 hours, I had nothing left. There was no sick coming up. There was no poo coming out. There was nothing. There was no water coming out of my penis. There was nothing. I was a mental wreck. And this nurse was embarrassed, and I can see his face now. Just didn't know what to say to me, and I certainly didn't know what to say to him.
I can only say to you and all those who have had this dreadful treatment, as a nurse, I'm sorry that I was complicit in it. Can't do any more. I can't undo what's been done. I can only say I'm sorry.
Peter is standing smoking in the yard, watching Fanny hold court with a few inmates. A man next to Peter throws down his cigarette, then walks off in disgust. Peter continues to watch Fanny until eventually he's had enough and walks off too. In the prison canteen, Peter's toying with his tray of food when he becomes aware of Dan watching him from the next table. Dan gives him a shy smile, then looks away. Fanny barges in and sits down next to Peter, making him bristle.
Landed on your feet there, girl. It's a lovely bit of stuff. Gonna get right in there.
Peter glares at him.
Sorry. Touched a nerve. Your business, I'm sure.
A newspaper cutting.
Seen this?
Peter frowns, then reads it.
Wolfenden Committee? See, they might want to change the law against queers. They want people to come forward, have their say. There's a few things I could tell them. We should all do it, don't you think? Band together?
No! No, we're not the same, you and I.
Peter angrily shoves the trays of food away, then gets up and walks out. The other inmates barely bat an eyelid. After making the trays neat again, Fanny eats a spoonful of food, but he seems preoccupied and a little bit shaken. When a guard looks through the peephole into his cell, Peter only half looks round. In the yard, he remains apart from the other inmates, who come and go and chat in groups around him.
I am a homosexual. For many years, I kept this a secret from my family and friends, and tried privately to resolve my struggle in a way as consistent as possible with moral law. I do not believe I ever did any harm to anyone. If any harm has been done, the fault lies not with me, but with those who dragged into the merciless light of publicity things which would have been better left in darkness. If there is bitterness in my words, I hope it will be the bitterness of medicine. Not of poison.
Peter is released from prison. Now the interviewees in the present day.
Just before he was imprisoned, he had just bought a house not far away from our flat. When he came out of prison, his neighbours had put up a big notice, "Welcome home." And I think that more than anything, gave Peter tremendous encouragement. These ordinary local people were accepting him for what he was.
March 1955.
I must have my say.
Orphandom needs to hear the truth.
Peter is back in his flat. After taking a bite out of an apple, he thinks, then begins to type. He writes a title page that reads, Against the Law by Peter Wildblood. Then he pulls the page out of the typewriter to inspect it.
I'm trying to get through to Malcolm Farr. The Home Office. Yes, I can wait.
In a gents' toilet, Peter stands at the row of sinks and dries his hands on a white towel. He catches his own reflection in the mirror and pauses.
I realised, with the setting up of Wolfenden and even before, that there was a change in the air.
It was the first indication that the law against homosexuality might at least be reconsidered, the first glimmer of hope. And so we all knew about it, straights and gays.
In a wood-panelled room, a nervous Peter sits down at the head of a committee of seven men and two women. March 1955.
May I say, Mr. Wildblood, how very grateful we are to you for finding time to talk to us this afternoon.
Not at all. But I was particularly aware of it because it so happened I was having an affair at the time with Jeremy Wolfenden, who was the son of Sir John Wolfenden, who was head of the committee.
You say there are three distinct types of homosexual.
Yes. The men who regard themselves as women through glandular or psychological maladjustment.
Group A.
Yes. Group B. Pederasts. I cannot speak on their behalf. I regard them the same way a normal man might regard those pederasts who prey on young girls.
And group C, men like yourself.
Homosexuals in the strictest sense. Adult men who are attracted to other adult men. Men who desire to lead their lives with discretion and decency. Neither corrupting others nor publicly flaunting their condition. We are by far the largest group of homosexuals.
The discreet homosexual?
Yes, my lord. We seek to find another of our own kind and, if possible, form a permanent attachment in private. But the law, as it stands, makes this kind of arrangement fraught with risk. A promiscuous and temporary liaison is far less likely to provide corroborative evidence, letters, that kind of thing in court, than an association in which genuine trust and fidelity play a part.
I see. Yes. I was going to ask a little more about Group A, the glandular category.
They're known as pansies.
Fanny returns to the gay bar.
People of that kind are born like that. To that extent, I suppose they're not responsible. What they are responsible for is their nuisance value. They cause a lot of bad public feeling towards the other more discreet homosexuals.
Grey-haired men on the committee look at him.
When I ask for tolerance, it is for men like us. Not the corruptors of youth, not the effeminate creatures making an exhibition of themselves.
An ex-inmate nods to Fanny to leave the bar with him.
I speak for the men who, despite their tragic disability, try to lead their lives as decent citizens. There are many thousands of us. How many we do not know. I believe that we would be better and more useful members of society if we were allowed to live in peace.
instead of being condemned to live outside the law.
In a tunnel, the man punches Fanny in the gut and face.
What did you do that for? Don't leave!
Do not fucking harm us!
Peter looks pleadingly at the grey-haired Wolfenden.
Thank you, Mr. Wildblood. You've been most helpful.
Thank you, sir.
Peter sits back, a flicker of relief crossing his face. Fanny lies bleeding in the tunnel. Peter Wildblood was the only openly gay man to testify before the Wolfenden Committee. After putting on his fedora outside the room, Peter stops, takes a deep breath, then strides onwards. In 1957, the Wolfenden Report recommended that homosexual relations should no longer be a crime when conducted in private between two men over the age of 21. The government took its time to consider the report.
You know, I was very pleased that the recommendations made, and I thought, well, the law will change, but it wasn't changed for another, what, 9 years or 10 years. And when it did change, you know, as I said earlier, I thought, oh, yeah, nice condescending thing to do. I was quite irritated by it.
Why was that?
Yeah, because I thought, you know, all these consenting adults in private. And if you had a threesome, say, you know, you could be brought up, sent to prison. Not that people, a lot of people wanted threesomes, but you know what I mean. And it'd be in private, in a house. And if there were other people in the house, you know, you were breaking the law.
The change in the law that took place in 1967, I'm quite sure, had an enormous effect on a huge number of gay people. But the problem was, it was a minor change. They weren't going to turn around to their parents and say, oh, by the way, I'm gay and it's legal now, so you can't do anything about it. They were still going to be hiding themselves. It would take a social change to bring real freedom to these people, not a legal change. That is not to minimize the benefit the legal change made, if nothing else, to stop people going to prison for something that was nobody's business but their own.
My mother was saying, I know what you're going to do. When later on, when I go, you'll marry a non-Jewish girl. I said, Mum, I won't marry a girl at all.
He has to stop for a moment.
It must have been a shock to her. But she just called me a dirty dog.
A photo of him as a smiling young man.
I did hold back particularly because I knew my family would disown me pretty well. And here I am now. And fortunately, I mean, it was only literally since September of last year that I was able to come out to my family, well, to my sister, younger sister.
Even there, I sometimes pinch myself and think, is it true? Has it happened? And I'm astonished. I would never have thought that the law would change, the public opinion would change.
Hello, darling.
Hello, darling.
How are you?
Not bad.
Oh, good.
And yourself?
All right. Thank you. You had a good time?
Very good time.
Oh, good. Well, we were the first couple in Westminster, as well as in the country, to actually form the civil partnership, which was very exciting, actually.
Roger, 89, and Percy, 77.
Lee died 2 years ago, and we've been together 66 years, and I found that letter that I wrote him amongst his effects, and the address, his name, my name, had been cut out. So I folded the letter up and placed it in his coffin so that it went with him wherever he went.
Yeah. Frank Stanton, 85.
Queer.
homosexual.
Roger Merchant, 67. A little unsteady on his feet, Derek Granger, 95, takes a seat.
There we are. Shirt lifter.
Flamer.
Never heard that one. Slamer.
Flamer, as in a flame.
Flamer.
Flamer.
Not one I've ever heard of.
Yeah, I'd say this. I hadn't heard Brown Hat.
Nancy Boy.
Queen. Friendly Dorothy.
Bernard Dobson, 89. Stanley Underhill, 91. George Logan, 72.
Bender.
Batty Boy.
Keith Biddlecombe, 80. Peter Price, 71. James Gardner, 69.
Fairy.
Martin Gordon, 87.
Very good at that.
I've heard them once or twice.
As George Montague, 93, gets up from the interviewee's chair, he bumps into the microphone stand. A flashback to Peter and Eddie bumping into each other. They never saw each other again. Then a photo of the real Peter Wildblood with the dates 1923 to 1999.